Hi, Peter Williams here. Are you on the RCR mailing list? Never miss a beat of the news and hard-hitting stories you've come to know and love. Stay in the loop. Visit realitycheck.radio/email or hit the join email button on your RCR app.
We've got Bob. So let's go across to Bob and we're going to be talking surrogacy. Good morning, Bob.
Or did you want to do it on Zoom?
I've got you now, Bob.
Oh, g'day, Rodney. How are you?
I probably jumped in a bit quick. Now, I got to tell you, you are a national treasure. And the information that you've got on your webpage, Family First webpage, is second to none. In the old days, I used to go to the business round table for policy papers, and it was always very impressive when Roger Kerr ran it, and whether you agreed with it or not, it was extraordinary. Now, because so much of it is of a cultural, ethical, moral question, the things that we're debating today, I go to your webpage, and truly, Bob, you've done an amazing job with Family First, and I salute you for it.
Well, thank you, Rodney. Regarding National Treasure, could you tell my wife that? Because I'm not quite sure that she agrees with that.
No, it's different. It's different. It's different when it comes to wives. All wives are hard done by.
Yeah, well, they are because they're married to us. That's
yes,
why, Rodney.
We're never good enough, and they're quite right to be saying that. And that's the irksome thing, right? It's always irksome because your wife's right.
Yeah. Now, my wife just tells me that what's hers is hers and what's mine is hers. And yes, that seems to settle it.
Yes. And that I've also learned that no matter how strongly you think you're right, you're not.
Right. Glad we've got that off our chest.
Yes. Now, I had not given surrogacy, I don't know how this happens, any thought, right? I heard you talking about it in one of your clips, and I learned such a lot and got quite alarmed. Then I went to your webpage where you have your great fact sheet and came away better informed and also alarmed. So I want you to walk us through what surrogacy is, the different ways it's done, what the law is, and what, if anything, is being proposed. Can you do that for us, Bob?
Yeah, and I think, you know, look, to start with is that it does sort of fly under the radar because it hasn't been in the focus because it's kind of slightly out there. And so when changes to the law comes about, it tends to be pushed by, well, unfortunately, I would say certain groups or certain people that may benefit from it. And so the big push for surrogacy in New Zealand has predominantly come as a result of a MP, Tamati Coffey, who's in a same-sex relationship and wanted children with his same-sex partnership and admitted on Sunday program that the bits don't work, the biology doesn't work, and so they need some help. And so with the of a woman who provided an egg, so basically the biological mother, and another woman who incubated the fertilized result for 9 months, the surrogate, then they were able to have a child. Now, what nobody is asking in this whole debate, and I will come back and just define the two types of surrogacies because I think that's important for people to understand, but what nobody is really asking, because this bill that's currently before Parliament, which surprisingly the more conservative government of National Act and New Zealand First have picked up and are pushing through as a government bill, not a private member's bill, is entitled Improving Arrangements for Surrogacy. And the word improving says it all. It's about increasing access and making it easier for adults.
So just get this right with Tamati coffee. He's in a, he's married to a guy, right?
Married in inverted commas.
Yes. They decide to have a baby.
They want to have a baby.
They want to have a baby, but two guys can't have a baby together just yet. So they go to a lady and get an egg.
Yeah.
They then somehow fertilize that egg. One or other of them, or both of them, I don't know how that works, right? Then they place that fertilized egg inside another lady's womb.
Yep, and so IVF is the word you were looking for. So, yeah, there are two types of, well, there's two types. So the first type, you've just described gestational surrogacy, and that's where the surrogate who carries the baby through to term isn't the actual biological mother. An embryo is created using an ovum and sperm from a male and a female, because biology dictates that you need a male and female still to create a life. And then the embryo is implanted in a surrogate. So the surrogate is not the genetic mother. So that's gestational surrogacy. Then you've got traditional surrogacy, which is where the surrogate mother's egg is used. So she is both the surrogate and the genetic mother, or the biological mother. And pregnancy is usually artificial insemination using the sperm of an intended parent or donor. And now, and the donor may have no desire to be an active parent of the child, and that's another issue. So one of the biggest concerns is that we are intentionally, not by accident or by divorce or by death or disaster, but we are intentionally setting out to deprive a child of either a mother or a father. We're deliberately setting out to create motherless or fatherless children. Look, there are plenty of family arrangements where because of circumstances, different family formations, different people care for a child. But I think we tread on dangerous ground when a society intentionally sets out to deprive a little girl of a mummy. And that's what it comes down to when you think about it. You may say, well, we just want to be in a loving home with two loving dads. But a young girl, as she grows up, will say, well, who's my mum? Where's my mum? Why didn't my mum want me? And
the mum, in the Tammany Coffee case, just to make it real and not picking on him particularly, but it's illustrative, The mum's only input may be the egg and nothing else. Never see the girl again, never have anything to do with it.
No, and if you watch the clip that we did on our website on surrogacy, you'll find that they actually, the biological mother who provided the egg says, no, she doesn't want anything to do with the child. So the biological mother is absent. And, oh, the other quirky thing, Rodney, was, and look, we use this case because they've put it out in public. They had a whole documentary by the Sunday program who were campaigning on this issue. And I'm not sorry to see the end of the Sunday program because they've campaigned on a lot of wacky things. But they Tamati and his partner provided the sperm, but according to the interview, they don't know which one won the race. So they don't know directly who the biological father is.
Oh, what a mess.
One of the two of them.
What a mess.
So, yeah, I mean, you talk about social engineering, which, of course, was the downfall of Labor, Helen Clark and the Labor government, with the light bulbs and the anti-smacking law and all that type of stuff. I mean, this is real social engineering. And look, I think,
tell me, how did they explain? Just, I want to understand this, Bob. I haven't seen the show. Did they explain how they found and how they chose the woman who gave the egg?
It was someone who offered. So often it can be a relative. It can be just someone who has benefited. In fact, if I remember rightly, I think the woman who provided the egg had also benefited from a sperm donor, so had three children of her own.
Okay.
Where the father was a donor, but not on the scene, and I'm not sure whether known to the kids. So once again, you have children growing up that don't know or don't have access or will never get to know who their biological mother or father is, because the under our law, the egg provider, the woman, can be anonymous. The sperm donor has to provide some identifying information, but they don't have to be involved in the life. They can hide. And in fact, there was a...
And they can hide case. They can hide from the child.
Yes, yes. They can just say they don't want any contact. In fact, there was a horrible case that was reported a couple of years ago of a guy that had fathered tens of kids. It was 30 or 40, I think it was. And people were trying to contact him, and he was actually sending out cease and desist letters to them saying, I don't want anything to do with you. I provided the sperm. That's the end of my involvement. Now, in New Zealand, the current law allows a donor, so any dude, could be a father, a so-called father in inverted brackets, of up to seven families. So you could have children wandering around from seven different families who are actually genetically related because they have the same biological father who just happens to be a donor. So, you know, that's where you get the statement, my daddy's name is donor. And, you know, once again, it just doesn't sit right. I think...
Bob. I'm sorry, you're across this and I'm trying to play catch up. So... this lady donates an egg because she's been in the surrogacy system or the IVF system, and so they get an egg. That's it for her. She doesn't even care. It's nothing. I don't even know. I don't know how they get the egg, but they get the egg. Then they go to a lady who they fertilize this egg, and then they go to another lady and they implant the fertilized egg in her womb. So she's the gestational surrogate.
Yeah, it may be the same lady. So if it's the same lady, it's a traditional surrogacy.
Yes.
If the surrogate is also the biological mother, that's a traditional surrogate. A gestational surrogate is where the surrogate is not the biological mother. Another woman has provided the egg. So there's a separation.
Now, what's in it for the gestational surrogate? Why would you carry someone's baby that's not yours and not your egg?
Well, I think deep down there's a sense of doing something wonderful for those who haven't got children. And, you know, that's the thing that I think, you know, we have to say from the outset, both of us have our own children, Rodney, is that, you know, we completely sympathise with couples
Absolutely.
Who struggle
Absolutely.
To have children.
Absolutely.
And I can understand why some consider going down the track of surrogacy in order to have children. But the problem is that the whole discussion is about adults' rights and needs, and there is no discussion at all about the rights and needs of the child. And that was the key message that we made when we went to make our oral submission on the bill that's going through Parliament at the moment. In fact, the irony is that in the explanatory note to the bill, it includes reference to the United Nations Conventions on the Rights of the Child, which is called UNCROC. And it actually says that a child has a right from birth to know their parents and to be cared for them. The problem is that surrogacy and sperm and egg donation go against that exact right. And in this bill, one of the things we said was, look, you seem to be pushing this bill through. We oppose it. But if you are going to push it through, you've got to change the legislation so that the overriding purpose clause is about the best interests of the child. Because at the moment, it's just a, quote, important consideration. And look, it should be the best interests of the child as to whether they have access to their their biological mum and dad. The other real concerning aspect around this, Rodney, as you can probably already pick up, is that there's the danger of the unintended commercialisation of surrogacy. Now, New Zealand operates on the basis that you can't be paid, as you often get in some Asian countries, and has been a concern in the United States of commercial surrogacy, which often exploits vulnerable women who simply want money. But the problem with the New Zealand bill is that reasonable surrogacy costs is very broad. It can include lost or diminished salaries and wages, a whole lot of other costs. And so sometimes it can become a financial incentive for a woman to, you know, give up 9 months for this recompense for carrying a child. And, you know, that once again, they then have no involvement in the future of the life. And we've got children who are growing up not knowing who their biological mum and father is. And one of the interesting things, Rodney, is that one of the most watched New Zealand on air funded TV programs is David Lomas Investigates. And if you've ever watched it, it's a series that reunites families, because it's about people tapping in. The program basically taps into the deep human longing and need to know who we are, where we came from, our whakapapa, our genealogy, you know. And the problem is that a lot of these cases that are covered are where there is separation of biological mother and father from the child.
So the surrogacy has the baby, the gestational surrogate. I'm back on Demity Coffey's thing, right? The two dads, the baby's born.
Yep.
The two dads take the baby at some point, and the surrogate disappears. So now, and I'm also conscious that Brooke Van Velden has got a bill for freedom of choice.
Yeah.
To allow adults to write on the birth certificate.
Yeah.
So you could have two dads on the birth certificate under her proposal, right?
Yeah.
So the birth certificate of this baby is then written up that it's Tamati Coffey dad and his partner dad too. That's the birth certificate.
Yeah.
So this this baby grows up. The two dads, you can't help yourself, right? You'd be looking at the baby and saying, is it mine or is it his?
Mm.
Right? And you'd work that out. It's a bit like Prince Harry. You'd work that out. And then this child's looking around, and you've got two dads, and says, oh, who's my mum? I want to see my mum. I want my mum.
Mm.
What's the answer to that as it stands, Bob?
Depends whether the egg donor, sperm donor, or surrogate wants to be involved. They don't have to be. So no matter what the intention of legislators is, and look, to be fair, some will be involved, some will stay involved, and they'll be known to the child, but there is no requirement. And so you have a lot of children who will never know who their biological mother and father is. They can access some information. One of the recommendations we made to the select committee was that they had to, if they pushed this bill through, which we opposed, but if they did, that there had to be provision for children as they grew up to be able to access who their biological parents were. And to be honest, that would put off a few donors. There's a few dudes going around donating their sperm who don't want any responsibility. They just think that they're doing something charitable by providing their sperm, and yet what they're doing is they're denying children the ability to know who their biological father is. You've missed out one other key aspect to all of this, which is concerning, Rodney, and that is that surrogacy and IVF also open up the door to sex selection and the prospective designing of a child. So in New Zealand, this is direct from Fertility New Zealand's website, you can choose a donor, so who you get the sperm off, based on information around the age, ethnicity, physical features, eye colour, height, weight, education, and personality. I mean, you and me are stuffed, Rodney. Nobody wants our sperm because we fail in all of those things. But there's been some disturbing examples overseas. For example, you might remember the case where a Melbourne couple aborted twin boys because they already had three sons and they wanted a daughter instead. The danger is that you start making choices, and I think prospective designing of children has always been a red flag, even to people who might agree with, who might like the idea of surrogacy. There's always been a concern around that, deep-seated concern.
I find it staggering, and I find it staggering that I've never thought it through, because I've always thought of IVF as couples struggling to have a baby, and they get assistance, if you know what I mean. And I've even been, and maybe the sister can donate an egg or something, you know. And I've been relaxed about it, but this opens up, well, even that, now when I think it through, it's the child. As soon as you think of it as like growing up, I just can't imagine having these two guys and you want to know who your mum is and they can't tell you. And they probably can't even tell you who the dad is because they have an agreement not to say. But this has huge ramifications too, because you might fall in love with your cousin or your sister or your half-sister.
That's true. Yep.
In fact, it's likely, because we know that when they bring siblings and even donors together with their children, they actually have an affinity for them.
Yeah.
And you could be walking around the supermarket, you're a 12-year-old girl, and you're saying, oh, that lady looks like me. I wonder if it's mum. This is unbelievable that they haven't thought this through. It's unbelievable I haven't thought it through.
Well, I think, deep down people say, look, what can be better than providing life? I mean, I wish they'd also say that when they're thinking about the abortion issue as well. Say, look, life is the priority. But they don't. But, we had Jennifer Lull from the Centre for Bioethics and Culture speak at our conference last year on this. And she just said this, women are not easy-bake ovens and children are not cupcakes. And yet that's what we're sort of reducing it to. Women are just the easy-bake ovens who are the surrogate for 9 months. But the problem is that you think what happens at birth or just after birth, you've got the surrogate mother who has bonded with the child for 9 months, and deep bonds are formed between mother and child during pregnancy. You and I can't relate to that, but we know what our wives were like. And then the baby is born, and suddenly they're relinquishing it. Oxytocin, the hormonal bond which is established, that's supposed to be reinforced after birth by the mother to baby physical interactions, the skin-to-skin contact. That's why when the baby's first born, straight onto mum's chest, and then the breastfeeding, that oxytocin link is so important. And yet what we do is we create this maternal separation, which is a stressor both for the infant, but also it can be a stressor for the woman as well. And I actually had an amazing testimony. She actually made a submission to the select committee considering this, where she was a surrogate, just like the example you gave, Rodney, where she was a surrogate for her sister, or it might have been her brother, actually. So she carried the child, and the whole thing just imploded. She struggled with the pregnancy, because even fertility associates admit that surrogacy pregnancies, because of the way it comes about, I mean, they say, quote, there is the possibility that your surrogacy pregnancy could be more difficult or have medical complications you haven't had before. I think, as you probably agree, Rodney, as soon as you start meddling around with the natural process, you immediately bring in factors that are out of our control and make things more difficult. And so she had these huge difficulties, and then, of course, the separation of the child. It basically, the family imploded as a result of it, even though she thought as a sister, she was doing the nice thing for her, I think it was her brother, actually, by carrying this child for 9 months and yet going through all this pregnancy difficulty. And then, I would say, I'm not a psychiatrist, but I would say the oxytocin connection and then the separation of the child as soon as it's born, you know, it's almost like Uber delivery in the birthing unit. Miranda Devine, who's an Australian commentator, I don't know if you know her, she spoke at our conference a couple of years ago, and she writes for the New York Post at the moment. She says this: to have carried a baby in your womb, shed a blood supply, felt its little feet kick against your abdomen, heard its little heartbeat, sensed it growing bigger and bigger while it changes your metabolism and the way you sleep, breathe and eat, and then to have given birth to a living, breathing human child you have been longing to cuddle is not a trivial act. So to have it described in clinical remote terms is insensitive and thoughtless, to say the least. It is so much more than being born through a gestational carrier, as if the woman was some sort of ceremonial archway through which the child was magically conveyed. End quote. I mean, it's a very good, synopsis of effectively what the process involved, which I think, Rodney, you know, many of us just simply haven't thought through.
Never.
We thought, this sounds nice, there's a nice result, but have we really thought through the implications of what we're doing and just how far this can go and the dangers of it?
Well, there's another thing too, right? There's at the moment of giving the baby up, but later on in your life, you know, like you may carry a baby at 25 and give the baby away, and then you get to 65. And as you get older, you actually feel that. Grandchildren, child, I wonder how they're getting on. Never had any contact. And meanwhile, the poor child has never known the mother. Not because the mother died tragically, but because a deal was done not to tell you. You would hate them. You would absolutely end up hating your assigned parents. I would. I'm sure I would. I'd be saying, no, I want to know my birth mother. And I mean, it must have an impact too on health. Like you want to know, you know, does heart disease run in the family? Oh, I don't know. Tell me, am I correct in saying that Brooke Van Velden wants to change it so the birth certificate would have two dads on it?
Yeah, so they sent out a edict, when was it, 2 weeks ago. Effectively, it says that you can choose whether you put mother, father on the birth certificate, and in fact, you can just put parent. I mean, I'm not quite sure. So basically, you're immediately creating a biological lie because, as we know, for every child, there is a male and a female involved. No matter what the process and whether there's surrogates involved or whatever, and whether one of them may have died between conception and birth, there is still a male and a female involved in the conception of that child. And so you get to the birth certificate, and then you're immediately manipulating the birth certificate to tell a biological lie, to say that somehow, in a miracle of science that has never happened before and never will happen, this child became about as a result of two dudes or two women. But see, the problem is that Parliament has already made a mockery of the birth certificate, because you and I could go to the Department of Internal Affairs today and we could just change our birth certificate to being born as a girl, that in fact the doctor got it wrong when we were born and our parents got it wrong, and our genitalia was confusing, and we're actually the opposite sex. So birth certificates are worth about as much as toilet paper these days because they can just be manipulated. Now it's not just manipulating your sex on your birth certificate, and it's supposed to be a historical document of fact, but it's also manipulating who the parents are, the biological parents, and creating this fictionalized social arrangement in effect, which, you know, all sounds very nice and appeases a very small minority group, but it's telling a biological lie, and I think we're always on dangerous ground when we go down that track.
It's extremely conceited. What's the situation with adoption? Because they've made it, the government has made it hard, as I understand it, to adopt a child. Because you and I don't think of unwanted children, right? And we would have it that rather than aborting a child, we know that there'd be loving families that would love to have a child. What's the problem with adopting a child, other than the conceit that it's not your sperm?
Adoption is a different kettle of fish because of the fact that it's dealing with a traumatic event, where the biological parent believes that they're in no state to raise a child, either young or just trauma or just doesn't want to be involved. And therefore we try and rescue the child and create, and generally, we've always argued, Family First has always argued that for adoption, we should be placing them into families where they have a mother and a father to give that complementarity of the sexes. Now, of course, the politicians have thought differently and said, no, it doesn't matter as long as it's a loving home. Well, we say it should be loving and both a mum and a dad and have that male and female complementarity. But, and that was as a result of the gay marriage bill in 2013, was that was the one of the consequences of changing the definition of marriage. It wasn't marketed and it wasn't promoted as such because they kept it under wraps, but that was the effect, that effectively anybody could adopt irrespective of the gender and ignoring that complementarity of the sexes. Now, Aranga Tamariki and formerly SIFs have always made adoption very, very difficult. They've never been keen on it. Adoption used to be in the thousands, it's now in, maybe it's around 100, but adoption has always been the best option, especially when the alternative is maybe abortion. But adoption is rectifying a problem, whereas when we talk about surrogacy, we're actually intentionally setting out to deny the child the biological mum and dad. Adoption is not intentionally denying the biological mum and the dad. It's the circumstances brought that about.
And also, as I understand it, you grew up as an adopted child. You love your adoptee parents because they care for you.
Mm.
But you do want to meet up with your mum and your dad if you can.
Well, they did a... Yeah, and Rodney, that's part of the reason why the law was changed probably during your time in Parliament to much more open adoption.
Yes.
And what was open adoption was about the ability for children who had been adopted to be able to what? Contact their biological parents, because we realised that was a right of a child to know who their biological mum or dad was. And that's why closed adoption became open adoption. Now, the other aspect is that there was actually a report that we quoted in our submission. It was done by the Commission on Parenthood's Future, and it's a report called We Are Donor Conceived, and it was in 2020, so 4 years ago. And they surveyed people who were as a result of being a donor child. So in other words, one of their parents, the egg was donated or the sperm was donated. Most of the participants were between 20 and 40 years old. And 71% of them, almost three quarters, agreed with the statement, the method of my conception sometimes causes me to feel distressed, angry, or sad, which is that statement that you made earlier on Rodney, and then 88% said they believe it is a basic human right to know the identity of both biological parents. But the problem was that when they reached out, about a quarter of them said that the donor ignored their attempts to communicate or refused to communicate. And as I said, some of them even got a cease and desist letter from the donor. So, yeah.
Only contact with your dad is a cease and desist order letter
from
a lawyer. Mm-hmm. It is absolutely heartbreaking. I've just got a couple of texts to read to you, Bob. Dead right, Bob. Disgraceful to legalise denying a child a mother. It is not normal to have two fathers and no female influence in their upbringing. Nature usually prevents this situation. Thank you, Bob, for describing the mockery of a birth certificate. How can we undo this legal biological lie? This is insanity. How do we undo it, Bob?
Well, the problem was that the birth certificates legislation, believe it or not, was passed by 100% of Parliament in the last parliamentary term. National Party were whipped. ACT basically supported it. Labor supported it. Greens supported it. Te Pāti Māori supported it. So New Zealand First went in Parliament, remember, then. So 100%, 120 MPs voted for making birth certificates a biological lie. So that's how kind of
tough it is.
Brainwashed the whole issue has become.
How brainwashed are you if you're Brooke Van Belden and my old party, the ACT Party, and you say writing two dads on the birth certificate is a freedom of choice issue?
Yeah,
that's like saying it's freedom of choice that I deny gravity.
Exactly. Yeah.
Now,
or
this is horrific, and of course, for a Christian, it's horrific.
Mm.
Because for a Christian, a marriage is a male and a female becoming one flesh.
Yeah.
And what we've done is totally destroy woman. Because we can have it now that a man can become a woman just by choosing to be. Woman's nothing special. I could become a woman today. You could become a woman today. And we don't even need woman to have our babies. We just pay them. We need them, but we just pay them. It's that destruction of womanhood that I can't believe. And woman seem to be the main ones in favour of this stuff.
Well, you've also explained the exact reason why we oppose decriminalisation of prostitution as well, because it just reduced women and children to be objects of commerce or trade, and that's what surrogacy does as well. It denies the special role and place that women have as mothers and as daughters, and, you know, when you get women that can be exploited because of their physical being and can be sexually abused and can be vulnerably used to be surrogates, then it shows just how much we've lost our way. And you're right, women are the victims. Men just provide the sperm and then they can move on and they can father children all over the world. In fact, there was an article a couple of years ago where a guy was actually a prolific sperm donor was visiting New Zealand, and it was almost being celebrated in the media that he was able to come in and come in and provide sperm to women who may need it. The European, interestingly, Rodney, about 10 years ago, the European Parliament actually condemned surrogacy. They said, quote, "It undermines the human dignity of the woman since her body and its reproductive functions are used as a commodity." So,
absolutely.
So these are some of the big questions we've got to ask. I'm glad you're having this discussion. You won't see this discussion in the mainstream media because all they're interested in is the social engineering aspect and appeasing the likes of Tamati Coffee type arrangements. But the rights of the child should remain paramount, and it's not a sexuality issue, it's a biological issue. And biology discriminates. If you've got a problem with discrimination, go and talk to God, because that's how biology works.
I've got a critical comment coming in on a text which I'll read out for you to reply to, but also I always feel that I must apologise again to you, Bob, because I was wrong about prostitution. I voted to decriminalise prostitution. It was a total mistake. I feel so horrible about it. I voted for gay marriage. That was a terrific mistake. I feel terrible about it. I bought the story that prostitution was always going to be a thing, and that by legalizing it, we could better protect women. That's a lie. I bought into the lie that two guys can love each other just as much as a man and a woman can, and can get married. I also thought that two men could raise a child just as successfully or better, and in some cases demonstrably so, a baby and a child. And I remember you graciously having me on your shows and you and I debating it. And you were right and I was wrong. And of course, we're on now a slippery slope, because we have abandoned the principle, and now we're at the stage where a government is saying, we'll just make a birth certificate, you can write down two mums, two dads, three dads, and add your dog in, because it's a freedom of choice issue. And I fell for it hook, line, and sinker. So I'm very sympathetic to people that disagree with me, because I disagreed with myself 5 years ago, Bob. So I just got to put that out there. I've changed my mind 100%, and it's largely due to you and your work. Now, on the prostitution thing, I just got to do a call out to Ro Edge. She's a lady on X. I started following her because she's very good on sports and women's role in sports, and leading men into sports, why that's wrong. Ro, R-O, Edge, E-D-G-E, Ro Edge. And she brought me up with a start, Bob. She often does with her tweets. And she said, prostitution is rape that's compensated for.
Yep.
And yep. I thought, that's actually true. There's no other way to me now of thinking about it. And as soon as that thought enters your head, you realize exactly why it's wrong. It's against a woman's will unless she's paid. I got a critical comment, Bob. Let me just describe this and see if you can respond. This text has come in. You can't fix current issues by going back to the barbaric practice of adoption. Many of us suffered horrendously from being forced to relinquish our children to what was deemed as a more deserving mother than we were. Adoption still commodifies the child. Adoption was full of corruption, guilt-tripping, and it's where the phrase legal fiction came from. It's the origin of issuing birth certificates with a lie on it. What's your response, Bob?
I would agree with her. I think adoption, the way it was handled in the old days, was criminal. I think the forced removal of children from their biological parents was wrong. I'm firmly full on the rights of the child that they should have access to their biological parents. And adoption, ideally, is where you're solving a problem, not creating a new one. So, no, I hear what that text is saying, because I think a long time ago that was the case. I think we got past that in the last maybe 30 years, where adoption was about fixing up a problem of whether it was death or disaster or divorce or whatever, desertion. And so it was fixing a problem that had presented itself. So it had good intentions in mind, but we've now got to the point where we don't see adoption as a solution. We see the way we create children and using women as surrogate commodities and using a man just for his sperm and a woman just for her egg and denying a child the biological right to a mother and father. We're intentionally setting out to create those examples. So, yeah, I mean, I think we dealt with adoption in the wrong way. I'm glad we went to open adoption. I think adoption is the best option, especially when the alternative is killing the unborn child in the womb, abortion. And so we need to encourage adoption. There's, what is it, it's 11, 12,000 children lose their lives in the womb every year because we don't consider adoption to be an option. We did.
Have you got time, Bob, if I open it up to some callers, because maybe some people want to call in? I'll open up the callers if we can. 0800 20 57 57 if you want to add a comment or a question or a critical comment. I promise you, you'll get your full hearing. We welcome criticism and calls. That's what we're about. So please just hop on the line. We'll take your call. The line is open now. And you can call and talk to Bob. Bob, where does this end? Like, what I'm saying is, technology is such that we'll be able to clone ourselves, won't we?
Yeah, I think one of the biggest concerns is designer babies. That has always been a major concern, and we're fast heading down that way. I mean, we're already in some ways halfway there with what Fertility Associates offers in terms of what you can choose when you toddle up to get your donor sperm. So we're already starting to go down that track. The interesting question for Brooke Van Velden is, look, if we can put two dudes on the birth certificate, could I actually put my local rugby team? Could they be the parents of the child on the birth certificate?
It's a freedom of choice issue, right? You could put the All Blacks.
And the other thing is, you know, why not group marriage? Why not polygamy? Are we talking about polygamy, polyamory?
Of course, you can't stop it. It is just a logical following on of what's happening. It's the same with the age of consent. You feel that will go because freedom of choice and children are doing it anyway. So let's just remove the stigma, yada, 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 yada. And it's difficult because what you're saying is you don't want to go back to the 1950s, but that's not what you're arguing, is it?
No, I don't think the closed adoption was a good model at all. In fact, if anything, I think closed adoption, which your text referred to, is actually exactly what we're doing now with surrogacy, because we're denying the right to biological parents. I mean, based on that text, that's what we're doing now. We're ripping children off the biological mother because we call her surrogate and say we feel all nice about that because we're providing the two dudes a child. And in effect, we're committing the same sin. So we haven't improved at all.
What's interesting is that we've had a case I recall reading in the newspaper overseas of a surrogate, I don't know whether she's gestational or not, but two men wanted a baby, paid a lady to carry the child. Baby was Down's. They said they didn't want it and wanted to her to abort the baby. She didn't want to abort her baby.
Yeah, baby Gammy was that one.
Ah.
Goes baby Gammy, born to a Thai surrogate mother and the Australian parents, abandoned her. And interesting thing, they took the healthy twin sister, but it was later reported, and here's the interesting thing, Ronnie, the surrogate mother fell in love with the twin she was carrying and decided to keep the boy. So there's that the connection and the oxytocin hormonal bond that goes on where the surrogate, and you think about it, oh, the surrogate may be getting paid and maybe thinking they're doing a great thing, but they give birth to this child that they've carried for 9 months and suddenly it's gone. That's not how birth care should be. That's not what it's about. It's not what the child
wants. I've got another text. In fact, it's the same texter, so thank you for that. Open adoption is still governed by the 1955 Act. At any time, the adoptive parents can pull rank and opt out. So the adoptive parents, that's the parents that have got the child, and they can pull rank and opt out. The birth parents have zero redress. It has and still happens often. Do you understand that?
Yeah, look, to your texter, that's a very good question. I thought some changes had been done to the Adoption Act. There were some legislative changes in 2023, which I'm just looking at. And so there have been changes in terms of opening it up. Look, I'm going to plead ignorance on this just at the minute until I do a bit more research on that. She may be right. And look, your texter may be referring to an adoption that was done under the previous Act, and so whether the changes to adoption were retrospective, perhaps that's the problem, that they weren't retrospective. So, I'm having a quick look at the Act. So, no, I in fairness, I'm not going to try and answer that because I may mislead, and I just need to do a bit more research on that.
Well, we've clearly got someone on the text too that knows what they're talking about. So we will need to research that. But texter, you're more than happy to call in, and we're more than happy to have you on the line explaining how the adoption laws work and operate and what changes need to be made. How did that child with the Down syndrome end up?
So the couple took the healthy twin boy. The healthy twin sister, but the twin boy who had Down syndrome, the surrogate mother kept. So it was a good outcome. The one of the boys got to stay with the biological mother, but the healthy twin sister didn't. And I mean, you know, what happens when the surrogate mother has multiple births? Who's the parent there? I mean, it just all gets very complicated.
It's unbelievably complicated.
Yeah. So, I mean, you could be sitting in class and you could be sitting next to a biological relative because of the fact that the same sperm donor donated to a group of women in the same area, you know, visited New Zealand tourism donor. I mean, that's how dangerous it can be.
What are the requirements, legal requirements on sperm banks? Do you know how that works?
Well, the problem with sperm banks, I mean, that's part of the law change that they were looking at. Fertility associates have a lot of restrictions around them, but the problem is that you are, and one of the big arguments against IVF is that you are fertilizing more eggs than you need.
Yes.
And so, you know, you're putting on ice a lot of what many people believe are human life, but you're putting them on ice. Because they're not needed embryos, so fertilized embryos. So, in effect, that's the concern. The ethical concern around that is that you're creating children, but then you're just discarding them because they're not needed. and there's been concern about that. There is a restriction on how much a sperm donor can offer. As I said, it's limited to seven families, but that's seven families that could interact later in life, and those kids grow up and fall in love with each other, and then you've got some issues. So, you know, this is the danger when we try to interfere with nature, and I always think when you start interfering with nature, you go down dangerous ground, especially when it involves human life. Different if you're dealing with genetic modification of a plant, but it's very, but that's totally different to genetic modification of a child.
Got another text, Bob. Several years ago, there was outrage over the legal fiction of birth certificates changed for adopted children so that their new names and that of their adopted parents show on the birth certificate. However, every adopted child will also have the original birth certificate in the system, as the biological mother is also required to register her child after birth prior to the adoption. I have two adopted children. One has a closed adoption at her biological parent's request, and the other has an open adoption. Although, strictly speaking, I shouldn't have known the surname of the closed adoption parents, one of my relatives knew what their names were, so when I asked for my daughter's revised birth certificate and the registrar office couldn't find it, they did after I was able to tell them the first and last name of my daughter's birth parents gave her. So I assume there's a note with it cross-referencing the new birth certificate. By the way, the adoptions happened at a time when open adoption was being encouraged. Both were placed for adoption because of disabilities. Oh, well, you're a wonderful person. You're a wonderful mother and father.
See, and that's where I think adoption is. There's been some, you know, beautiful people that have stepped in and adopted in a time of need because of disaster or desertion or death. And, you know, you take your hat off. That's rescuing a situation. But that's very different to a woman putting their hand up and saying, oh, here, you can have my egg, or a guy saying, oh, you can have my sperm, and then saying, but I don't want anything more to do with this child, and denying that child to grow up and access to the biological parent. That's a very different scenario, isn't it?
Tell me, give us a call, people, please. We're wanting to try our talk back. And we've trained you well to text, but we need you to call also. It'll be so lovely for me to have a caller. 0800 20 57 57. And I want to show off to Bob that we can get someone to call in. Bob, what's the law here in New Zealand with how the contract, do you know, or is it even outlined, or has it got to go to court to be decided, that Tammany Cox, I'm always picking on him. I bear him no ill will, but it's just the example, and it's good to have it concrete. Tammany Coffee, I mean, here's the other thing. The gestational mother, if she could produce eggs, they've sort of rejected her eggs, haven't they? They're saying, oh, we don't want your egg, we want this other lady's egg. I mean, that's complicated. But what's the legal situation if that same thing happened in New Zealand? So Tamati Coffey got a surrogate, kid tests for Down syndrome, two dads don't want Down syndrome baby. What happens then, do we know?
Well, that actually is part of one of the arguments in the new law that was being put forward is, what actually happens if the surrogate decides that they want to keep the child, which is quite possible when you think about it. You know, you have a woman yes. carrying a child for 9 months and then suddenly decides that, pardon me, suddenly decides that they actually want the child. So the law needs to be very clear about what happens in those situations. And the other situation, of course, is the surrogate carries the child and then the intending parents don't want it anymore. And once again, that's where the law has to be very clear about, you know, what is happening and what will be the effect of the law. And that's where it gets so tricky when you get round to that, you know, get into that type of scenario.
We've got the situation too, where we have, you know, Hollywood celebrities who don't want to carry their own child because it'll upset their acting career while they're pregnant or whatever. And so they can pay someone to carry their child, and that happens. So it's like I'll pay someone to have my baby, biological baby. And again, you have a scenario like, what happens if Tammity Coffey and his husband divorce? Because then the child's got trauma all over the place, right?
Yeah.
I've got a question for you. The texter that we have that's very knowledgeable, and we may not be able to answer this, Bob, have just said, I'm at work and so can't call in. Ask Bob what adoption legislation he's referring to. As far as I know, there's only the Adoption Act 1955. That'll be true, but it probably is amended many, many times. There's no legislation from 1955 that wouldn't have been multiple times amended. There have been calls for many years for it to be repealed, but clearly there are not enough votes in it. But I suggest that just because it's original 1955 doesn't mean that it's hasn't been changed many, many times, right?
Yeah, well, according to the government website that I'm looking at, it's had changes in 2018, 2020, 2021, 2023. Mm. I mean, for example, it would have been changed as a result of the same-sex marriage law, that law being changed. So, look, maybe true. I came on for surrogacy, not a
yes.
doctor.
No, not at all. I'm sorry I got you onto that. Here's a lovely text. I'm adopted 62 years ago, and although there were lots of struggles growing up, I'm always thankful abortion wasn't easy back then for obvious reasons. From Shelley. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
There's no answer to that, is there?
No.
Two very good books by Nancy Verrier, The Primal Wound and Coming Home to Self, which explores the psychology of effects of separating a child from their mother in the context of adoption. Worth a read, Bob. Cheers, Monica.
Yep.
Are you familiar with those books, Bob?
Yes. Yeah. And I'd also encourage books by Jennifer Lyle as well, who spoke at our conference last year. I'm just going to look it up while you're talking. Let me just check. So she wrote, they did a documentary film, a couple of them called Exploitation. That's a play on exploitation, but it's Exploitation. Anonymous Father's Day, which is a documentary exploring the stories of women and men who were created by anonymous sperm donation. There's a book called Breeders, a Subclass of Woman, which focuses on surrogacy. And, yeah, there's been a few books. Actually, maybe she hasn't written a book. I thought she had.
Here's someone that went. Our number, by the way, is 0800 20 57 57. A couple of more texts. I'm a woman living in a happy same-sex relationship. We had a civil union in 2007. I wanted and needed a legal document to protect us both financially, and I guess the civil union did that. I have never believed marriage was appropriate as it's a religious ceremony. What do you say, Bob?
Well, that was our exact argument. In fact, the civil union's legislation of, what was it, 2001 or something, or 2002, actually changed hundreds. More than 100 pieces of legislation to recognise the fact that a couple, irrespective of their gender, could still have their relationship recognised. There was concerns about, like, next of kin, and if one of the partners was dying in hospital, whether the other partner would be allowed to go in and visit as a near relative. So you know, the civil unions sold that thing. And when the civil unions bill was being sold to us, Helen Clark said, you know, we're not touching the Marriage Act. Marriage is purely for heterosexual couples. We were given all these promises. Even Green MPs were saying the same as well. But, of course, we knew what the ultimate aim was. And the ultimate aim, actually, you'll be interested to hear this, Rodney, is that gay marriage was never the ultimate aim. The ultimate aim wasn't about marriage as such. It's actually about gender and completely confusing the culture and removing any mention of male, female, man or woman. Yes. So marriage removed it, but now we're getting to the point where kids are being told, well, you don't need to be either male or female. You can be agender. You can be both if you want. You can sort of fluid across from one to the other. And so they're removing, and that in effect is what Brooke Van Velden is doing with birth certificates, removing that whole gender requirement of male versus female. That's always been the long-term goal, because when you remove male and female, then you remove effectively the Judeo-Christian values that have come down, that we're born male, female, and that it takes a man and a woman to create a child, and that a child needs a mother and a father. We can't even define what a woman is now. We're now cancelling mothers and fathers from birth certificates, and we're just creating the perfect storm of confusion. But it's all about denying nature and God's design. And that's what our culture is doing.
And the very origins of critical gender theory were rooted in the view that they will create this confusion to bring down Western civilization.
Well, even Marxist groups like Black Lives Matter said that part of their purpose was to destroy the nuclear family. Now, amazing. A lot of people don't know that, but that's in their documentation. But that's what all leftist groups want to do. They want to destroy the traditional natural family, because when you destroy that, it means that people have to turn to government and Marxist ideas and control from elsewhere, because they lose that anchor in their life. And so that's why we've worked so hard to fight for things like marriage and the rights of mothers and fathers to be able to raise their own children, and for children to be recognised and protected and not told that they're the opposite sex to what they actually are. So we'll always fight on the side of nature because that is the simplest way.
I want to read you a text and ask you a question. To Rodney, it's a lovely text. Thank you for your public confession of your political voting for the time you're in Parliament. Mm. As a Christian, I forgive you for these choices. May God bless you and touch your heart with peace. From Aaron, which is a beautiful text, and I feel it in my heart.
Yeah.
But you have always been like that, Bob. You forgive people. You forgive people who are wrong. You forget. You were so gentle with me when I would argue with you that you were wrong. And that's a Christian thing, right, in you, that you try hard to do.
Well, I think that's one of the things we've always tried to do in Family First, is that we don't tell people what to think, but we will certainly present the evidence as to what we believe and why we believe it, and put up the argument. And I find that in most of the social debates that we've had on abortion, euthanasia, marriage, conversion, so-called conversion therapy, drugs, that when we're actually given the opportunity to present our side of the argument and to present basically biological truth and, for me, basically God's design and understanding that, then that will always come through strongest. And it will persuade people. Now, what you've got in our culture is a very strong anti-Christian, liberal, left-wing view that has to be rammed down in the form of diversity, equity, and inclusion, except it doesn't include your view if you're still a Christian. Mm. And it has to be rammed down in the form of hate speech. And hate speech is simply a admission by the left that their arguments are pretty weak.
Yes.
And so they've got to criminalise people who challenge it. And yes. So anybody, I mean, you might have seen this week, Rodney, that the PPTA are discussing a
possible change
to their constitution to get rid of he, she, and just replace it with they, because it's gendered language and it's exclusionary and it doesn't take into account male teachers who are pregnant.
Mm.
That's a quote from the proposal. Male teachers who were pregnant.
I follow you now, I follow you on X, I follow you on Facebook, and it's great because I don't have to read the news and you do it for me. Now, we've got a caller. I'm very excited because this is all new technology to us. I'm just trying to bring the caller on. Good morning, Stella.
Oh, yes. Hello, Rodney.
We're so excited that you called. I want to encourage people to call 0800 20 57 57. I have to let Bob go soon because we've got to get TalkBack working to make the community. But you're on with Bob, and I'm sure you've got a point to make or a question. You go for it, Stella. The floor's yours.
I'm the one who actually wrote about adoption, and I'm the one who adopted two children with disabilities.
Yes, cool. Thank you for that.
With Down syndrome. Both, by the way, diagnosed after birth because, you know, these days, if you're diagnosed before birth, the chances of being born aren't that great. I think the other person who's writing in about the closed adoptions and that, she might, you know, the way things were done in the 1960s wasn't great, the reality is that, you know, a lot of those people, if abortion had been around, might not have been born.
Yes.
Yeah, and I do, I have a friend who discovered her birth mother, and in her case, she was glad that she was adopted out after meeting her birth mother. I'm sure most people are, it's the opposite, but in her case, that's what happened. What else was I going to say?
Tell me, Stella, when did you adopt your children? What years?
Oldest one was in 1989. She's about to turn 35.
Goodness me.
Yeah, and the other one was several months. The first one was a month old, and the other one was about 9 months old at the time that we adopted her, and that was about 28 years ago. That's right, because she's 29 at the moment. Yeah.
And one was a closed adoption at the parents' request.
Yeah, and it was her birth parents who chose the closed adoption. It wasn't us.
Yes. And that meant that...
In a small-wheeled scenario thingy, one of my cousins actually went to school with the birth mother. we did actually make contact with the grandparents on one side of the family. We still haven't got contact with they've both since died. We haven't had contact with the rest of the family, partly because I've respected the fact that they want it closed. I have tried, like when she turned 21, I sent a CD of photos and that to the grandfather who was still alive at that stage, and, you know, in the hope that maybe he'd send it on, but I've never ever heard anything from the closed adopted parents.
And how did it go for the child that was open adopted?
We've had contact off and on. I remember when she was first adopted, or somewhere along the line during the whole adoption process, the social worker saying that quite often with adoptions that after a while the birth parents go off and have their own lives sort of thing. And in this case, we did have quite a bit of contact in the first few years. The parents were in a sort of unstable relationship, and they were both quite young. They actually split up at one stage. Well, they split up several times and moved away for a while, came back. We had a bit to do with them. I actually looked after, she has an older birth sister, so I actually looked after the older birth sister while a younger birth sister was being born. and there's been other children since. So over the years, it's sort of been a bit on again, off again. It's a bit more on again now.
Did you feel a bit threatened? Did you feel a bit threatened by your, I don't know if it's a daughter or a son, your child meeting their birth parents?
Not really, because, we had quite a bit to do with. At one stage, they were all going to the same place, entered together.
Wow.
And then the birth mother moved away again, but with the children. She's not really. I mean, maybe to do with the fact that she's also got Down syndrome. So I know the older one with Down syndrome was probably far more conscious of the fact that you know, her younger sister had contact with birth parents and she didn't.
Mm. You got a question or comment, Bob?
Yeah, I think, you know, has been a little bit harder on her, and also they've actually moved away to another country. So, yeah.
Have you got a question or a comment, Bob?
Oh, Stella, nice to hear from you. I was just doing a little bit of research while you were talking, and, yeah, look, we are operating still under the old 1955 Act, which doesn't impress a lot of people. There was a change. There was Adult Adoption Information Act 1985, and then there was Intercountry Act in 1997. So there's been a little bit of movement, but the Ministry of Justice have been doing a review of the whole law, and it's quite interesting because they want to do adoption law reform, and they did a first round of engagement in 2021 and then a second round of engagement in 2022. And it looks like they're now looking for some more feedback. And in the meantime, the Minister of Justice at the time, Kerry Allen, got herself into trouble. And so there seemed to be some changes from that. The Law Commission obviously has done the review of surrogacy laws. So it's kind of like there's a lot of noise around this, Stella, but the open adoption seems to have come around 1985, would that be correct?
Yeah, that sounds right. Tell me, Stella.
Yeah, because we did the older one, she was actually kind of adopted under the old system in that you had the social worker coming in to visit you and that sort of thing to assess, you know, whether you're suitable parents and stuff. And then it went and changed. So what happened was we started in that system, and then I actually became pregnant, so we put everything on hold, and then our daughter was born and unfortunately died. And then later the same year is when we actually adopted the first child. And then they changed to the famous adoption weekend thing, and initially I think you had to pay for it. And we had friends going through that system, and they said to us one day, well, you don't have to pay anymore. You can do it for free. So we sort of turned up, two small children in tow, because by that stage I'd also had a birth daughter, and attended, I think it was two, maybe three adoption weekends, and it was very negative about adoption.
Mm.
You know, to the extent that, yes, we did have an adoptee come in who basically hadn't had a very good experience and all the rest of it, and there was talk about being child-free. And, you know, I'm sitting there thinking, well, you know, hello, if people were happy about being child-free, would they actually be turning up to adoption weekends?
Yeah.
I mean,
Tell me, Stella, tell me this.
Yeah.
Everyone wants a perfect little baby. And you chose, not your child, you chose to adopt two babies with Down syndrome. What was your thinking?
Well, the funny thing was, at the time that we applied, you know, to go through the adoption process, I was 32, I think I was 32, 31, 32. And I was considered too old. I mean, it's a bit mind-boggling now.
Yes.
Yeah. then, you know, well, you know, to, I guess, a teenage mother, I'd appear pretty ancient or something. And then when I got pregnant, I was an elderly prima gravida. So you're sort of thinking, ah. At 32, I was feeling very old. So I said, because I'd had experience looking after children with disabilities, I said, what about ones with disabilities? And the interesting thing with that is that you get presented with a long list that you tick off. Gee. And I remember going through it and thinking, oh, I don't know if I want that child. I don't know anything about diabetes. And I never actually got round to giving that back because I became pregnant. And then our daughter actually ended up, well, two of the things I did tick actually was Down syndrome and spina bifida. And our birth daughter had spina bifida, but unfortunately she died a week after birth. And then both the daughters I have adopted have got Down syndrome. The second one I met via the IHC because we were going to do shared care. Then the birth parents kind of went off us and went on their own way. And then 9 months later came back and changed their minds and decided to place it for adoption. So, yeah.
And at any stage did you doubts or regret that you had adopted two Down syndrome children?
Well, the first baby was actually a perfect baby. Second one wasn't. She screamed her head off, and, you know, if I was into giving kids back, I would have given her back. To be honest, the second one sort of has more behavioural issues.
Mm.
So it has been quite difficult at times, but then again, you know, I've got friends who have adopted like Russian children and they've not had an easy time. I still remember when we took the first daughter with Down syndrome to meet my mother, who lived in a different town. She's since died. And she sort of, and at that stage, Romanian adopting from Romania was big, you know, mm-hmm. there was Romanian mm-hmm. orphanages on the news and that. And my mother said to me, oh, you know, if you'd told me I'd pay for you to go over to Romania to adopt. Well, having had friends who have adopted children from Russia, adopting those children isn't guaranteed an easy life either. So, yeah.
Thank you, Stella. You are a stellar mother. You are amazing. Thank you so much for taking care of those beautiful daughters.
Yeah. No, well, they have brought a lot of joy into our lives as
have.
Well.
I bet they have. Good for you.
I mean, you know, it's ups and downs of life anyway. And we did have another daughter in between those two.
Right.
Oh, she was actually born 14 months after the first one. So we adopted the first one. Then the next thing you know, I discover I'm pregnant. I'm going,
Stella.
But the pediatrician, what a life. It was the best thing that we did for the first child was have the second one that close. It was actually easier having two close together than having one, the last one is, there's 4 years between her and the biological one and five between her and the next one. And it's actually, the gap actually made it harder.
What a great story.
Even though it was, you know, quite a bit of work in the first Stella, years with the older two.
Thank you for texting.
Yeah.
Thank you for ringing in. I love it. Okay. I've got to teach our audience to ring in. And it wasn't hard, was it?
No, that was good. Yeah.
Thank you. Take care, Stella. Okay. You're a wonderful person. Okay. We've got Paula, and then we better let Bob go. Paula, good morning, Paula.
Good morning, Bob. I mean, yes.
Rodney.
And Bob. Sorry. I'm not thinking properly. Anyway.
Paula, what's on your mind?
Well, I wanted to ask you guys about what Bob's thoughts were on the whole case between Sunita Torrance and Brian Tamaki. I'm not sure if you've discussed that lately and was interested to hear your thoughts.
You know the case, Bob?
Sorry, what was the first name you said?
Sunita Torrance, you know, she's that gay, you know, they were getting paid $1,800 a session and the library talks for the drag queen.
Got it.
Sorry, not gay.
Yeah.
The drag queens that talked in the libraries.
Yeah.
And So South Taranaki District Council implemented that, and they were paying them $1,800 a session, I think I read.
Yeah.
And now she's suing Brian Tamaki for $2 million.
What's your thoughts, Bob?
Yeah. Well, don't want to preempt the court case. I mean, it's a pretty high bar to get defamation, as you well know, Rodney. I just think she's... I mean, where's she getting the funding from to take this case against Brian Tamaki? That would be the interesting thing to find out. I wonder if any government funding is coming in. I mean, Brian Tamaki has, in fairness, raised the issue that drag queens shouldn't be in front of children. Actually, I have a close Australian mate, Lyle Shelton, who's going through this same thing in... it's not Victoria, it's... one of the other states, and Queensland, and he's before the vilification board because two drag queens got upset that he said they weren't appropriate for children either. Look, I'm happy to go through vilification courts because I'll say the same thing. Drag queens are not appropriate to be in front of children reading that type of material. Drag queens have always been adult entertainment. It's about time we made things age-appropriate and took care of our children. So
total 100%. If it's any help, Paula, I'm 100% supporter of Brian Tamaki and what he's been doing. It's not my particular style. I don't think it's Bob's particular style, but he's absolutely in the right direction, and he's doing God's work, and he has actually stopped the drag queens from talking to little kids. And you just got to keep asking yourself, why do these drag queens want to talk to little kids? And
correct. Now, can you please tell me, why did Paul Brennan, when he interviewed Sunita Torrance, not ask those questions? I was so, so disappointed with that show, and as were lots of others. And we were really disappointed that Paul didn't take both Sunita and Brian a bit more to task about everything. It was very... PC, too PC, and not what I thought RCR was totally about. Like, if you'd been talking to her, Rodney, I'm sure you would have asked a lot more better questions.
Yeah, well, that's kind, but I can't speak for Paul, and I didn't hear the interview, but I'm dead against these drag queens speaking to little kids in public libraries.
Thank you.
100%. It's just disgusting. And, of course, our schools are equally as bad and are culpable. And the fact that teachers aren't speaking out in droves shows to me that they lack a moral spine. And they know that if they speak out, that they will, their careers at best will go on hold and they'll possibly end. That said, you would end your career to protect the kids.
Well, exactly. Like, the kids come first.
Kids
and that should be
first.
Our priority. And people shouldn't be choosing money over health and what's right and morals.
Bob, what's your view on the teachers not speaking out on what's happening in the sexuality education in the schools? We know that they'll be vilified. They have been vilified if you speak out. But still, you should.
Well, I think the encouraging thing is that a lot of schools want nothing to do with it. And we saw that with the recent Pride Week that was held in the schools. 90% of schools had nothing to do with it. So it's really a very small minority of schools that are pushing this issue, and a lot of teachers want nothing to do with it as well. In fact, I had a teacher last week text me to say he managed to get through the curriculum without any of the wacky stuff, which I knew exactly what he meant. So, look, I think, give credit, the 90, 95% of teachers just think it's totally inappropriate and just want to teach our kids what parents want them to be taught, which is reading, writing and arithmetic, and not educating and not indoctrinating. So I think, we just encourage parents to make sure what's going on at their local school. I know Rodney's had a lot of issues with his local school, and the good thing is that hopefully we've empowered him to push back, and he has. So that's the key thing. We just need to push back where we see evidence of it happening.
Paula, thank you for your call.
So many people say that we can't do anything, but they forget that together we are mighty, you know.
We're mighty.
If we all take a stand, then we can do it, you know.
Absolutely. You're dead right, Paula, and we've all got our little bit to play, and Brian Tamaki is a great leader on this. I interviewed him, and I came away so impressed by the man and what he's done. And he was very open about his background and his life, and I was extremely touched. Mm. Thank you, Paula. Bob?
Yes, that's great. Thank you, Rodney. Thank you, Bob.
Thank you, Bob, for coming on. And I'm sorry that we got into adoption, but it is I didn't mean to do that to you, but it did raise up the issue. I'll let you get on with your fabulous work and remind us of your webpage, Bob.
Familyfirst.nz, that's where it all is. I've got to do a bit of preparation for a live show tonight at 5 on Facebook and Twitter and LinkedIn and YouTube. So
well, while you're here,
we're going to talk about all things political.
Tell us about your live shows that you do, quickly.
So we do political playback on Thursdays at 5 o'clock, and that's me and Simon O'Connor discussing sort of what's happened in Parliament over the week. Monday night with one of our guests is Rodney Hyde on the panel, and also Peter Williams. It's a panel of about 5 or 6 discussing all the topics of the day, so that's always fun, 8 o'clock. And Simon does a live show on a Tuesday morning as well. So it's all on our website, familyfirst.nz.
Well, you're doing a great job, Bob, at building up an alternative media source. It's not just a resource now, your webpage, but you're actually getting a great media presence. So good for you.
Yeah.
That was
all good.
Thank you,
good
Bob.
To be on the show, Rodney.
That was Bob McCoskrey, and it's Coskrey. What a great guy, doing great work.
The RCR shop has great gift ideas, from great looking tees, hoodies, caps, tote bags, bumper stickers and more. The RCR shop is now open at www.realitycheck.radio/shop.